Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Plays the Thing. In this next series, we are going to be discussing William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. I'm Matthew Bianco, and I am here with Brian Phillips.
Hello.
And Heidi White.
Hey, guys.
Save the best for last.
Oh.
I immediately thought, wait, I should have done ladies first. No.
There you go. You saved that. That was perfect.
Saved. All right. So we're here to discuss for the next several weeks the play Julius Caesar. And the question that immediately comes to mind for me is, why of the Shakespeare plays is this a play that everybody, almost everybody, is always assigned to read, wherever it is, right? I mean, the Circe apprenticeship, this is one of the plays we read. In high school, most high schools, this is one of the plays you read. Why is Julius Caesar such one of those plays that has to be read?
It's a really good question. I think part of the appeal of Julius Caesar is that it's relatively straightforward in its language. You can read Julius Caesar as a high school freshman and get a sense of Shakespearean language. It's a little bit of getting your toes in the water. It's fairly easy to read. And also because the plot line's pretty straightforward. It doesn't have those complex plots that the high comedies have, nor is it the intensity that requires so much, well, not requires, that's debatable, that sometimes feels like it requires so much specialized knowledge of tragedy. And it is a historical play. And I think that's appealing, and it's politically relevant in every era. And the rhetoric is so fun to teach, the idea of persuasion, and especially in Act Two, which we'll get to next week, with Caesar's death scene and the resulting speeches that come from it. That's very often focused on in the classroom. So I think for those reasons, it's a good starter play for people who are not as familiar with Shakespeare. I don't know, Brian, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I agree. I think that it's a perfect play for combining the study of history and Shakespeare. It's not as complex in reading and interpretation, but as far as wrestling with the bigger questions, I think it's just as complex and interesting and fun to wrestle with, you know, as any other Shakespeare play.
Mm-hmm. True.
I like the comment that it's politically relevant to every era, because apparently every era contemplates assassinating its leaders.
I can't think of an era that hasn't, but maybe that's in our bright progressive future that we're going towards.
Mm. Yes, well, it's in our future and over 2,000 years behind us as well. Some things have changed.
Yeah,
true. That's true. I do think the question of how far is too far and what do you do to protect against the perceived loss of freedom or liberty is a question that people wrestle with throughout all ages.
Yeah.
So maybe not assassination in particular, but
action of some sort.
Yeah.
The Declaration of Independence is a way of dealing with that without assassinating the ruler.
It is.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
His minions. You kill a bunch of his minions, but not the ruler himself.
Yeah. Right. Well, I guess if Thomas Jefferson had lived in ancient Rome, which seems to have been something he really wanted to do, then maybe none of this would have happened. But alas, he did not.
Right. they probably wouldn't have been as classically educated either. Just going by his.
That's actually really true. All right. Don't want to derail on that, but you're so right.
He would have had about the same New Testament, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Also true.
I wonder how many people are scratching their heads like, wait, what?
Oh, well, see, we're already starting to follow the rabbit trails.
You can't help it. They're there everywhere. So one of the things that I think about Julius Caesar being read, I think you guys are right that it raises these big questions, these good questions, and that it's relatively simple, for lack of a better term, I guess, but it lacks some of the complexity that some of the other plays might have. It's pretty straightforward. I agree with all of that. I think that's perfectly true. But yeah, it's not, I don't think of it as being preachy. Like in the asking of the questions, it's not being preachy about the answers to the questions. It's not moralizing for us, right? So it's allowing us to ask the questions and then wrestle with them in the context of the play. But then they also become part of our way of, they become part of who we are. So then they become questions that we wrestle with in light of the circumstances of our own era, our own lives, our own situations. And I think perhaps whether by accident or intentionally, educators know that these are the kinds of questions we need to have in our storehouse to wrestle with as we become adults or leaders. So it must be part of the curriculum wherever you go for that reason, I think.
Right. I agree with that. I think one of the, another kind of side reason I've heard mentioned before is that, and I just think this is funny. Like, I'm not bringing this up as some kind of moral reason why people should read Julius Caesar, but I think this is hilarious that when they were developing curriculum, that they put this play in there a lot because there's nothing sexy in it. So they didn't think it would be a temptation to young people. So I think that's funny. There's adultery or
sex in it, though.
Does it? I didn't know that. Thank you.
Portia says it.
Actually,
she's referring to her biological
gender,
sex, but yeah. You
know. Yeah.
I've never heard that as a reason, as a justification for it. Huh.
I don't know. Is that scene where she shows her thigh?
Yeah. I mean, that's.
Okay.
But so compared to other plays though, right?
Yeah.
That's true.
I mean, it's one of the most perverse plays, of course, is what Taming of the Shrew. So,
right.
Relative to
no
that,
Taming of the Shrew. That's
say no
sure.
Taming of the Shrew.
Right. Matt, to your point though, about this play exposing really good questions, big questions without being preachy. I think that's an excellent point, but, I think that would show through even more if we were as aware of the historical background and setting as some of Shakespeare's audience would have been, I think. So the historical background, I think, is very important when you come to this play, not just in what it brings up, but in almost what's assumed the audience would know. So those will be some things as a history teacher that frustrate me that I'll be bringing up throughout these podcasts. Just fair warning.
Brian,
well, I think that's such a good point, Brian, because and with the conglomeration of the three of us, like I teach literature, Matt's more of a classicist and he has a very philosophical mind. and you bring that historical knowledge to it. So it's going to be fun having the discussion between the three of us about this play. So what do you think? I mean, the play opens in Act One with...
As plays are wont to do.
Right. Yep. That's right. Act One, Scene One. That's how it goes.
So predictable, Shakespeare. So predictable.
Try something new already.
Right? So it opens up with a bit of staging with mm-hmm. this conversation. Who are the two characters? Is it Marcellus that it opens up with?
Marcellus and Flavius.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so...
Just look on page one, Heidi.
Act one. I know. I was looking at Act Three in the storm. So now I'm going back. I'm sorry, Scene Three in the storm, but now I'm going back. All right. So Flavius, and then they're walking through, they're discussing the triumph of Caesar, which is about to take place. And they do give us a bit of a setting, right? Act One, Scene One in Shakespeare is often orients the audience to the action that is about to take place. And that is what's happening here. So what would an Elizabethan audience have been able to tell from this scene that might be lost on a modern reader?
Well, I think the most important thing is his questions about, let's say, around line 40,
okay,
where he's discussing Pompey and how the triumph of Caesar comes through the blood of Pompey. Now, he was one of the Roman consuls at the time, and he was an opponent of Caesar's. And so when Caesar comes back, at this point, it's with Pompey dead. Mm-hmm. And so now Caesar's the only one to actually claim power in Rome. They always had multiple consuls, and now with Pompey dead, Caesar's really the only one. He's coming with his army into Rome, which was a violation of Roman law. It was technically an act of treason. And so while people are welcoming Caesar back as victorious, as a hero of Rome, for different reasons, they seem to be forgetting, at least according to Marcellus, that Caesar's triumph came through the blood of Pompey. Now, right. What makes this complicated is that from all we can tell, Caesar didn't actually kill Pompey. Pompey tried to kill him and tried to have him brought up on charges of treason. They were trumped up charges, which leads to that famous scene of Caesar crossing the Rubicon to enter Rome with his army.
Right.
Which again was technically an act of treason, but his army refused to leave him because they knew if Caesar comes in with no protection, then Pompey's going to kill him. So Caesar is, you know, I either enter Roman territory alone and die at the hands of Pompey, most likely, or I enter with my army, survive, but I've committed treason, which leads to that, you know, famous line, the die is cast, right? And sure enough, he enters and has a small skirmish with Pompey's army, Pompey's men. Pompey flees to Egypt, and there Cleopatra and her brother, I believe, if memory serves, knowing that Caesar is pursuing them, they cut off Pompey's head and present it to Caesar in a basket as a gift. And Caesar weeps when he receives this quote-unquote gift. So already, and I bring that up and I'll stop there. There's a lot of other stuff that could be mentioned and that I'll mention later, but already there you have a good example of the kind of tension that continues throughout this whole play, is that you have the assumption by some that Caesar is a hero, right? He's the protector of Rome. And then you have the assumption by others that Caesar is a danger to Rome and he's going to be a tyrant. Now, in that one example, you could look at Caesar crossing the Rubicon as an action of a tyrant, right? Or you could look at it as a wise decision of a man who has faithfully protected Rome, is trustworthy, and was just trying to protect himself with the death of Pompey. you can do the same thing. If you see Caesar as a tyrant, then he was pursuing his political enemy all the way into Egypt and was going to murder him. Or you can see it as, no, he wept when he saw that Pompey was dead and perhaps was going to try to make amends. You know, we don't know. That was according to Caesar, right? So your assumptions play into everything in this play, preconceived ideas. And there's just one historical situation after another that is really throughout the life of Caesar and the life of Rome that play into whether you see Caesar as a potential tyrant or the hero of Rome.
That's right. That's very interesting to me because I didn't know all that history. I mean, some of it, but much more vaguely than how you've described it here. But I've always read the play as it being, as it having those kind of assumptions involved, right? Yeah. Like you can read it where Caesar is, must be put down. And then you can read it where, you know, Cassius is overselling it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize, I'm pretty sure I've been told by people that history is much more cut and dry, that in the historical record is that Brutus did the right thing. But it sounds like you're describing it much more, that even there are different circumstances that might cause somebody to interpret it one way or the other.
Yeah. And like I said, some of that goes back before Caesar's time as a public figure. So there's baggage that the senators and the Roman people are bringing into this historical circumstance. So I would not say that the historical record is more cut and dry. I think the historical record's a little bit more enlightening and makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
And it does make me wonder if Shakespeare's audience would have been more aware of the history behind it. And part of that might just be that I'm a bit cynical about our culture's historical knowledge anyway. Mm-hmm. So I assume they knew more, but maybe not. And maybe Shakespeare is bringing in a little bit more one side of that into the play, but I don't know.
I think you're right, Brian. I think that the Elizabethan audience of Shakespeare's day would have been very familiar. However, Shakespeare, true to form, is a bit subversive here because Julius Caesar was universally acknowledged in the late medieval times as a great historical hero. Mm-hmm. He was beloved of the people. And he's mentioned several times in Shakespeare's work, notably in Richard III, which came out a few years before Julius Caesar, which incidentally was probably the first play ever performed at the Globe Theater. Was Julius Caesar. During the time when Elizabeth's reign was declining and she had no successor, which is a very big deal in in scene two here of act one. So the idea of succession being the general creating general anxiety among the people of this beloved ruler, Queen Elizabeth, who has saved them from the Spanish Armada, and she was unexpectedly great. No one thought she was going to do anything. She was right on the heels of the Reformation, and she was a Protestant queen. This is so much turmoil in this day and age. And Caesar was seen by these people. Every era has its own historical consciousness, right? And so Caesar was seen as someone who brought peace to a troubled empire. Mm-hmm. And so Shakespeare, again, true to form, comes in, and Caesar is not, I mean, that this is, I mean, maybe debatable, but he's not very attractive in this play, and he dies in Act Two. Really, it's the tragedy of Brutus, this play is. And so, and he is portrayed as ambitious, grasping to be made emperor. So now we look back on it with a lot of question marks, right? Maybe they needed to become an empire. Maybe the Roman Republic had run its course. But Caesar is definitely the bridge generation between the Roman Empire, the Republic, and what became the empire. And there's a lot of ambiguity on how each era interprets that transition. And Shakespeare just goes right to the heart of it in his typical fashion. I don't even know, as I've said in many podcasts, I don't know how Shakespeare happened. He's just unbelievable. And his ability to kind of plug into the psyche of an entire public and private individuals and raise these anxieties without casting judgment on our conclusions of them.
I take umbrage with that.
You do? How so?
Well, I take umbrage with several things that you've said so far. The first is that you called me a classicist. And being one of those, I would like you to know that I would pronounce it classicist.
That's fair.
Heartsies.
My apologies.
Thank you.
Now we're getting somewhere. Okay.
I know. This is so great.
But
the public should know. Please, our listeners should know that Matt and I, he may say he doesn't like banter, but this
I
is.
Never said.
No, he just doesn't like other people's banter.
I don't like small talk.
He likes my banter. We have this
is not
be
small
and
talk.
Arguing and Brian egging us on and saying wise things in between our arguments. So
the other more important thing that I take umbrage with which I take umbrage.
Good grammar.
Thank you. Uh-huh. I am a classicist. Uh-huh. Is that Julius Caesar doesn't come off very well in this play. I think that Julius Caesar's character has that same level of ambiguity that Brian was talking about earlier with the history and the behavior. And I think there's a way to read it and see Brutus as the honorable person who did the honorable thing. And there's a way to see it as Brutus got played. Mm-hmm. And Julius Caesar did not deserve to die at all and was a good ruler and would have continued to be a good ruler. I think all of those things will be like, I guess I'm saying all that to point out my umbrage, but also to maybe set the stage. Cause I think those things will come out as we go. I mean, I don't want to spoil the play in act one, but actually we're still in scene one for that matter, for everybody when there's so much to come. Right.
Right. Well, and just to quickly clarify, when I say that Julius Caesar doesn't come off super well in this play, I mean, Julius Caesar as, and you can still, I hope you convince me of this, honestly, I'd be happy to eat my words on this because the ambiguity of how Shakespeare draws his characters is one of my favorite things about Shakespeare. So yeah. I'm hoping to change my mind. When I say that though, I mean Julius Caesar as a man, not Julius Caesar as a ruler or a public figure, because everything you said about the, how you can interpret that what takes place on the public level is 100%. I completely back you up on that. I totally agree. So to move on to scene two then, since we're still in scene one, it does open. Oh, go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say scene two, it brings up the issue that you mentioned about succession. And let's see, around line six, Caesar and Antony, Calphurnia is there, Caesar's wife. They're attending the race. And as Antony is about to leave to begin his race, Caesar says, forget not in your speed, Antonius, to touch Calphurnia. For our elders say the baron touched in this holy chase, shake off their sterile curse. Mm-hmm. So that was the belief that if one of the one of those participating in the chase touched a barren woman in the course of the race, then her sterility, her infertility would be reversed or removed. So you have that issue here. Caesar without an heir, his wife is barren. And so he broaches the issue in conversation with Antony. And so you have that issue of the successor brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's particularly, it's interesting to me because here's yet again, a specific detail where if you see Caesar as a hero, then you see a man who wants a child.
Yes.
Right. You see a father, a husband who wants a child. If you see Caesar as a tyrant, you see, look, he's trying to get a successor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which was frowned upon in Rome, right? I mean, you had to rise to the position of consul. It was not a hereditary title. Mm-hmm. And so the assumption that Caesar wants to become king, that Caesar wants to rule Rome himself, is confirmed in the minds of those who already think that, mm-hmm, when he starts mentioning wanting a child.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is really good. The other important thing to point out about just this little incident at the beginning of scene two, one is the issue of succession, which you said so well. And then immediately after that, we have, you know, the most famous line in the play from the soothsayer, "Beware the Ides of March." And Caesar completely dismisses him. Mm-hmm. Whatever, man, right? But we do see he's superstitious about his wife,
mm-hmm,
potentially getting magically pregnant, right? So this, and I think this is really, really important to this play, because so much of this play deals with the supernatural versus the utilitarian. We have Cassius, who's so utilitarian. He's in this scene, so I'm not jumping ahead or giving any spoilers. Like, he's, and Casca, all the conspirators are just, I mean, vehemently, we have to do what works for Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the wives, who are always having dreams and these portents and these presages and these intuitions. And kind of how those two things clash creates a lot of the conflict in this play. And we see it right away here with Caesar. When he wants to be superstitious, he is. When he wants to be utilitarian, he is. So it shows the conflict between those two things, those two themes and motifs right here at the beginning of the play.
Right. I think omens are one of the themes that you come back to time and time again. You have to really pay attention to these. It is interesting to sort of extend what you're saying, that Caesar seems to observe at least one small superstition about his wife. I was trying not to laugh into the microphone when you said about his wife getting magically pregnant.
Yes.
that's an interesting way to put that. But,
well, I mean, he was going to be involved, but it was going to be the magic. So,
would you like to explain that to any of the students listening?
No, okay, that's good. One of the appealing things about Julius Caesar is that there's none of that.
So. Right. So I think
took me a second, but I got that. None of that stuff.
But notice this jumps out to me, is that Caesar will accept superstition when its interpretation is coming from him.
Right.
Hmm. When he encounters it among someone else or among other people, encounters it in someone else, he doesn't trust it.
Yeah.
And that is yet again, another one of those confusing details where you could take it one way or the other, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
See, he won't listen to anyone else. He's only concerned about his own authority, his own opinions, his own ideas. You can't trust a man like that. Or he has a good head on his shoulders.
Right. You could see his evidence of his courage and
he's not easily given over to fear or, yeah.
It seems to be that it's connected somehow with the office though.
Huh.
When it's a superstition directed toward the office of Caesar, then he accepts it if it's positive because he believes so much in the office.
Hmm.
I mean, reading it from the positive perspective, right? In a positive perspective, mm-hmm, of Julius Caesar. So superstition applied to Calpurnia is appropriate because she's a mere mortal. She's just a woman. And she has this issue or lack thereof. And which is interesting too, because it never occurs, at least in the play, it never occurs to him that he might be the one that is sterile, not her. But mm-hmm. but the superstition applies to her, and then superstitions applied to other people are fine if they're superstitions that get applied to the Caesar, if they're negative toward the Caesar, then they can't be true because it's the Caesar, right?
Right.
And
right.
if they're positive, then it's then he. So you know, later on, we're skipping out a little bit, but in Act 3 or in Act 2, there's going to be this moment where there's a competing interpretations of a superstition toward Caesar, and he's going to choose the one that's positive because only positive things can happen to the Caesar, I think.
But that's part of the problem. I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
No, go ahead.
That's part of the problem with omens. Mm-hmm. Right? That's one of the things that you learn throughout history, throughout this play in particular. Any omen can be interpreted either way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're not really particularly useful.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and to add to that, Brian, a lot of the imagery in this play, if I was teaching this play, I would be on this like white on rice. Like with my students, it's pay attention when you see anything that has to do with night and day. Because in this play, the imagery of daybreak is so, I mean, it's pervasive throughout the whole play, all the way into Act 5. But it is almost always connected to some kind of violence. Like it's used as a prediction or an omen, as you point out, of coming glory, right? A new day for Rome. Once the tyrant has been killed, then we can have the break of day for a new golden age of Rome. And then that's not what happens. However, on the other side, at night, you have... And in Act 2, we'll see this. And a little bit here with the storm in Scene 3, you see kind of this sense of mystery and darkness. And yet that's where wisdom comes. When in the darkness, that's when the wives have their dreams. That's when Brutus is actually questioning himself and saying, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. He has insomnia in the play, right? And in the play... And in the insomnia, he questions and he goes towards, he's going back and forth towards wisdom. So there's this kind of this mystical wisdom, which is in some ways very, like a very Christian idea. That's what the mystics who Shakespeare potentially could have read, we don't know. But that's a lot of the message of Christian mysticism is that in the mystery comes enlightenment, not in what men might call the enlightened day. So it's that subvertive image throughout the play of daybreak versus night. And it's used in an unexpected way.
I like that. One of the things that always hits me about Shakespeare is how the supernatural always employs the natural, right? So when there are really big things going on, the natural world reflects that. I mean, you see it in Scene 3 here, Act 1, Scene 3, with the storms and the meteor shower and the lion. All those omens, right? But you see it in this happens a lot in Shakespeare's plays, right? I think Tim and I talked about this and David in the King Lear episodes, that the storms there are indicating, some sort of spiritual turmoil. Then, of course, as Christians, we think about the star in, pointing the Magi toward the birthplace of Christ. We those kinds of connections are very real for Shakespeare, less so for us today, even though they perhaps ought not to be. And I think it's also perhaps what people love about Flannery O'Connor, right? That the physical world is so sacramental in her writing. What's especially fascinating for me, to me, about Scene 3 is not just the use and the introduction of that, the natural world communicating spiritual things, supernatural things, but the reactions to it. Mm-hmm. So you get Casca scared out of his wits, and then Cicero's like, this is great, I love it. Have you seen a more wonderful or beautiful sight?
Right.
And then Cicero leaves. Casca's still freaking out about it. And then Cassius comes on the screen or stage and says, and also welcomes the signs. Mm-hmm. And then Cassius has this kind of, what Brian, what you were talking about with the way of interpreting omens, where he says, I bared my chest at the storm, mm-hmm. and basically called on the gods to strike him. And Casca says, what? Why would you do that? Why would you make yourself vulnerable like that? But then Cassius, of course, is going to interpret that as, and they didn't strike me down, so I'm on the right path.
Right.
The thing that I'm plotting and planning is therefore appropriate, right? So now he's interpreting signs and omens the way he wants to as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which Cicero addresses in that scene. I don't have line numbers, so I can't, but it's about, I know. I just have one of those little, like the little ones, you know, that just little Macmillan.
I think books. We call those defective.
Right? I really need to get my giant.
Did it have a cover on it when you bought it?
It's a beautiful cover. That's why I bought it. I buy pretty books, and then later I learn I should pay attention useless. To whether or not it has line numbers. But it's after, in scene three, it's in the first part of it, and when Casca's talking to Cicero, and Cicero basically says exactly what you just said, Brian, which is, indeed, it is a strange disposed time, but men may construe things after their fashion, glean from the purpose of the things themselves. So here is Cicero saying, yep. Those may have been portents, they may have been omens, but we don't have any idea what they meant, or they could have just meant nothing, but we're going to hear what we want to hear.
Cicero copies me all the time.
Right. Yes. Kind of like time backwards kind of thing. Time bleeding backwards.
Heidi believes in time.
Well, that's particularly interesting since, as you know, Cicero mentions this sort of in the middle of where all the omens come. Mm-hmm. It's almost like Shakespeare uses that comment to remind the audience that there are two ways to look at these things, mm-hmm. right? And both the omens that have already happened and the ones that are to come.
Right.
You know, I think we missed some important things in scene two, though, didn't we?
Might have been a couple important things there.
Whatever. Oh, the whole humanizing of Caesar. That's good.
And please convince us of that. But yeah,
well, go ahead, Brian. And this is where Cassius begins to convince Brutus.
Yes.
That Caesar's to be feared, right?
Mm-hmm. So here's where I put in my bias and my interpretation. So I think Brutus makes the wrong decision. I think he destroys himself and his own soul and potentially Rome.
Just in scene two?
No. But in order for me to say what I think about scene two, I have to say that. Here I think that Cassius, and I want you guys to argue with me. Please don't be gentle with me. This is my
interpretation. You're going down, woman.
Play, right? Yes. Yeah, so bring it, Matt. I think that Cassius is the devil. I think he is the serpent, the seducer. And here, I think he plays upon a hidden pride in Brutus, uncovers it, and then uses it to destroy Brutus and Caesar and Rome.
Himself.
And him, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, he does destroy himself through it, which is fitting, fitting and appropriate. So in Act Two, we have the first example of a great rhetorical speech, and it's actually from Cassius. And the play is full of rhetorical persuasive speeches in the classical style. So when but the way that Cassius gets to Brutus is by calling him virtuous. So when he sees him in the street, have they heard from Casca at this point?
No.
They haven't. Okay. But Caesar is coming back into the city and he's having a triumph, even though he has not. And this is actually, as you, a kind of a big deal. And as you pointed out, Brian, this is a little bit of specialized historical knowledge, which perhaps the Elizabethan audience would have known, but it's important in interpreting the play. As Caesar is coming to Rome, he's having a triumph because he is coming as a victor over Pompey. But technically, he hasn't defeated a foreign power and expanded the Roman Empire. So why is he having a triumph? And this is something they discuss in scene one. And so it's creating some anxiety within the Senate of he must be coming to claim the throne since he's having a triumph, which is usually reserved for victors who have expanded the empire over foreign powers. So this is why there's been some unrest among the people, the people are fine, among the Senate.
And the tribunes in scene one.
Exactly, yes. So they're worried that he's coming to create an empire. And maybe he is, maybe he isn't. But here, Brutus and Cassius have this conversation, and Cassius says to him, I know, again, I'm so sorry, I don't have my, I will next week, I promise.
I think
a little bit into
90.
The conversation, when I know that virtue to be in you, Brutus.
Yes, that's line 90. Okay. Following along at home.
For those who have the right edition, I know that virtue to be in you, Brutus, as well as I do know your outward favor, while honor is the subject of my story. And then he goes on to kind of put in his mind this idea of conspiracy against Caesar. And he defends his point brilliantly. He uses Aeneas and Anchises, and these appeals to Brutus's honor and the glory of Rome. And he tells him this, and that, I think, awakens within Brutus kind of a hitherto unknown, very deeply seated pride in his own virtue that leads him then to a great sin. That's my interpretation of this act. Other people see this very differently.
Well, this sort of supports your point that if we do take Cassius as the tempter or as the devil, as you said, if you look at line 33, I don't think you even have to wait until line 90 to see that. This is when they're still outside of the games or the course where Antony's about to run. And Cassius is talking to Brutus. He says, Brutus, I do observe you now of late. I have not from your eyes that gentleness and show of love as I was wont to have. You bear too stubborn and too strange a hand over your friend that loves you. I think the temptation actually begins there, where Cassius plants sort of a seed of doubt.
Yeah.
You know, isn't something wrong? You know, you don't seem yourself, which I don't know that I would have thought of it until you mentioned Cassius as the devil or as the tempter, but you could see that as, you know,
right.
Cassius trying to plant the seeds of doubt that you seem like something's bothering you. And he connects it to Caesar. And it's actually from there that the conversation continues and
that you're right. That's
true. Launches fully into, appeals to pride and vanity. And that's where in the Garden of Eden, that's where the serpent started, right?
Yes.
As God said, you know, did he really say this?
Right. And, you know, did God really say?
Right. He starts with doubt.
I read this. Sorry, am I cutting you off, Brian?
No.
I read this book recently called A Gospel Grotesque. And it's written as kind of a response to Paradise Lost. And there's a scene in there where Lucifer is tempting the first angel to join his side. And he approaches the angel and he says something like, has God ever thanked you? And then the angel's like, huh? What? No, he hasn't. And then and then just, you know, that's his temptation right from there, yeah. Right? Like,
right.
So my interpretation of this scene is not, I don't think it's any different than either of yours. I think of Cassius as a tempter, and I think of Brutus as getting played. My concern is more on the Caesar side of it, because I think that Cassius, in doing what he does, actually reveals perhaps that Caesar is not what he's building, except doesn't realize that he's doing that. So the whole buildup for Brutus is that, and this comes out clearer, I think, in the scene at his home in the middle of the night when he wakes up.
Yeah.
But the whole argument for Brutus is that Caesar is an ambitious person who must be stopped. Except Brutus himself admits, although we don't have a whole lot of evidence of that, but you know, like a snake in an egg, you got to kill it before it's born.
Right. Exactly.
But Cassius's argument here is something more like he's trying to say that Caesar is not worthy, or what he's actually communicating is that Caesar is not worthy of any attention.
Or at least no more than Brutus.
No more than Brutus, right? So what he does is he actually ends up really, really humanizing Caesar and, you know, showing how Caesar has his own wants and fears, has his own weaknesses, you know, strengths and weaknesses, has a normal sounding name, you know, whatever that means. and it's interesting that to me, he actually makes me more sympathetic with Caesar in an attempt to try to make Brutus less sympathetic with Caesar.
Right.
Well, go ahead. I was going to say too, that if Brutus's issue with Caesar is his ambition, look at the way Cassius tempts Brutus though, around line 142. Sorry, Heidi.
Nope, I got this. I haven't memorized, okay. So no, I'm just kidding.
Excellent. Cassius says, what should be in that Caesar? Why should that name be sounded more than yours? Write them together. Yours is as fair a name. Sound them. It doth become the mouth as well. Weigh them. It is as heavy. Conjure with them. Brutus will start a spirit as soon as Caesar. So I don't think that he's... Well, he is trying to humanize Caesar again, but he's also trying to elevate Brutus.
Yes, he is.
He's appealing to Brutus's ambition.
Yes.
While pointing out that the problem with Caesar is his ambition.
Mm-hmm. So he raises Brutus while...
Decreasing Caesar.
It's kind of brilliant. And to support that, I these are the lines I was looking for before. You can, Brian or Matt, tell me what line I'm on. This is shortly after the first speech you guys brought out. Brutus, I do observe you now of late. It's a little bit down from that. Starts with 'tis jest, and it is very much lamented.
That's it. 54.
Okay. 55. 'Tis jest, and it is very much lamented, Brutus, that you... Oh, I'm so interested in mirrors in Shakespeare. Mirrors are always so important. And it is very much lamented, Brutus, that you have no such mirrors as will turn your hidden worthiness into your eye, that you might see your shadow. These lines are just so, so brilliant. What he's saying on the outside, like on the surface, is I wish that you had a mirror so that you could see your virtues, Brutus. But then that line that you might see your shadow, in Elizabethan times, in this context, they would have read that as reflection in the mirror, right? That's an appropriate interpretation of it in Shakespearean English. Now, there's also a very, very much a double meaning in that. Right. And in holding up your virtues, I'm awakening a pride in you, Brutus, that now you're going to see your shadow side, the dark side of you. Right. That's what he's trying to awaken. And that's what his actions are going to do. They're going to become a mirror that shows him that all along he was not as virtuous as he thought that he was. And that goes to both of your points and that great rhetorical speech, and when Cassius gets him to buy into his treachery. That he is elevated. He's playing on this pride in his own virtue. It makes me think of, have you guys read Paralandra?
Yeah.
Remember when Weston tempts the Green Lady and he is making her, he's working on that pride in her that she's so virtuous that she's like this great heroic queen. And because of that, then she should sleep on the fixed lands. Because she's so virtuous that she is not held to the moral law. So that temptation works on Brutus.
One of the things that I want to point out, I guess, at this point with this particular scene is the temptation to think Cassius is right about the need for a mirror. That we can't see ourselves and we need somebody to reflect ourselves back to us. Yeah. It's just, in this case, Cassius himself is a bad mirror. And I wonder if the bigger point is that another person can't be a mirror. Ought not be a mirror. Like there's a great line in the Meno where Meno says something about Socrates, and Socrates says, no, I know what you're doing. You're drawing an image of me. You're describing an image of me to provoke me to respond by describing an image of you. You want me to tell, you basically want me to say something nice about you. You want me to talk about you, and I'm not going to fall for it. That's not what this is about. And then he continues the pursuit of answering the question, what is virtue? But also within Shakespeare, you find another play that tells us what the mirror ought to be, what it is that's the mirror that holds a mirror up to nature and reveals our nature to us, reveals to us who we are. And in Hamlet, that's the play.
Right.
It's the play, the story, the overall play, the overall story is what holds, is what is the mirror that reveals who we are to us, right? And in many ways, I think even the way we interpret it is revealing something more. Like perhaps that's why Shakespeare writes his stories in a way that there's that kind of ambiguity. They're not preachy, right? So we can learn something about ourselves by which direction we interpret it.
Right. I think that's great.
So to your point, or at the very beginning, Brian, if my assumption in every line is that Caesar is a tyrant, that reveals something about me.
Right.
If my assumption in every line is that Caesar is just a man, a husband who wants to be a dad, you know, and just a human being, then that reveals something about me as much as it does about Caesar.
You're either going to be an assassin or a campaign manager.
Right. I think
it does. It does. The questions that Shakespeare raises for us are meant to be wrestled with, and he's not going to answer them simply. There's another example of this at the end of scene two.
Okay.
Heidi, could you stop turning your pages so loudly? Gosh.
Well, if they can tolerate my coughing, then maybe a few page turns aren't too bad. Around line
Thanks,
one.
Thanks, Brian.
Yep.
I'm going to start mouth breathing into the microphone.
Around line 192, Antony's done with the games, and Caesar and Antony are talking now afterwards. And Caesar calls Antony over and he says, "Let me have men about me that are fat."
Amen. Amen, brother.
He's speaking here of Cassius. "Let me have men about me that are fat, sleek-headed men."
Hey, I got that one too.
Yeah.
Two for two,
Matt. And such as sleep at nights. Do you sleep at night?
I do sleep at night.
Wow.
I do. Yeah.
Caesar would love you.
Yeah.
"Yon Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous."
That's so good.
I do the think too much thing though. Three for five.
And when you only eat meat, you're usually hungry, right? Are you hungry? Right?
Well, in fairness, it is lunchtime here.
Yeah, there.
So how would you interpret this then? You hear these words from Caesar. If you're convinced that Caesar's a tyrant, then you go, see, he just wants lazy yes men.
Right.
He doesn't want people around him who are going to think, who are going to question him, who aren't just going to fully endorse whatever he wants them to go along with. And then Antony responds, "Fear him not, Caesar. He's not dangerous. He's a noble Roman and well given." And Caesar says, "Would he were fatter, but I fear him not." Then you have the other side of this that, if Caesar is noble and a Roman hero, then, you know, you don't really question that because you're automatically assuming that Cassius isn't trustworthy, right? You're assuming that Cassius is the devil, the tempter, and that, he just doesn't want to be loyal to any authority over him. So again, nearly every word from Caesar, every action from Caesar in this play can be interpreted just like all the omens, right? Mm-hmm. Caesar himself is like an omen in this play. Is that he, and yeah,
I like that. I'm writing that one.
There's a lot to pursue there. Everything he does, everything he says can be interpreted both ways. And that's why, I mean, the question in this play that every teacher, every homeschool parent has to focus on is, should the conspirators kill Caesar?
Right.
That is the question of the play. And you have to pay attention to how all of Caesar's actions and words can be interpreted through both answers, if you will, or pursued, you know, on both sides.
Well, and especially in this early part of the play, the question is, should they kill Caesar? And if they should Brutus participate in it? Right. And all of that goes to whether or how you interpret Caesar. As you point out, I think that that's exactly true. But I do want to say, I think there's a little bit of a false dichotomy in the early part of this play that is created by Cassius. And that is the idea that if Caesar is ambitious, that must necessarily mean that that's bad for Rome. So he connects those two. Caesar is ambitious. He wants to be the emperor, and therefore Rome is doomed. And for the glory and the good of Rome, he has to be removed.
But what he really means is, therefore, I'm doomed.
Yes.
Right. don't like it.
Right. So I don't buy that. That one follows the other. So the idea of whether or not Caesar is ambitious is, that could very well be true. And that could also be for the glory and the good of Rome. So I think that there's a false premise there.
This really boils down to the definition of ambition, though, right? Is ambition a necessarily negative thing? Or
see, we're going to have to come back.
Best.
Yeah, we're going to have to come back to those two questions.
Yes.
We're going to have to come back to the nature of ambition. Mm-hmm. But then we're going to have to come back to whether Caesar's ambition to be king, or actually the title emperor, would not have been nearly as troubling to Romans as king. Whether that ambition would lead to the downfall of Rome, because I think that that's another issue. That's a historical context thing that we're often missing here, but I don't want to bring it up yet because it becomes particularly apparent later.
This is a back pocket argument.
right. I'm saving that one. Just so you know, guys, keep listening because I have some good stuff later. Not so much this episode.
Okay. Also, we can't forget that Casca. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why do we believe him? I mean, at this point, in Act One, Casca says, "Well, he would fain have had it. Casca. They offered him the crown. He turned it down. But he would fain have had it."
I think it's because he's funny.
How the heck does Casca know?
Casca's hilarious. And therefore, we trust him.
Yeah.
Because implicitly, he kind of disarms us with humor, I think.
Because he's fat and sleek-headed.
Actually, there's a scene where right at the end of that scene, Casca leaves. Mm-hmm. And Brutus says, "What a blunt fellow is this grown to be. He was quick metal when he went to school." And Cassius responds and says, "So is he now in execution of any bold or noble enterprise? However, he puts on this tardy form. This rudeness is a sauce to his good wit, which gives men stomach to digest his words with better appetite." That there's something going on in Casca, but he hides it and he disguises it by his behavior, by his geniality, by his words. And I think one of the problem, or one of the things that could get us into trouble, is that if we read Casca's words here and assume that he's trustworthy.
Yeah.
Like we're already aware that Cassius might not be trustworthy. We ought also to consider that his buddy Casca might not be trustworthy either, and is part of this conspiracy to get Brutus on board. that Cassius is not a serpent acting alone. He has a buddy with it, or he has somebody helping him, perhaps. And that person might be Casca, who is imputing motives to Caesar that might not have been there.
He does. I mean, when he reports on the people trying to give the crown to Caesar three times, he says things like, basically, it seemed to me that he really wanted it, but every time they offered it to him, it was harder and harder for Caesar to refuse it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And his disdain for the common people.
Right.
Is very obvious. I mean, it's humorously worded to us anyway, but,
if the Tagrag people did not clap him and hiss him as he pleased and displeased them.
The rabblement hooted and clapped their chopped hands, threw up their sweaty nightcaps, and uttered such a deal of stinking breath because Caesar refused the crown that it had almost choked Caesar, for he swooned and fell down at it. So Caesar swooned while rejecting the crown because the people's breath was so bad as they shouted for him.
I never thought about distrusting Casca here, because isn't that in Plutarch, which was Shakespeare's primary source? Is it in Plutarch that Caesar refuses the crown three times? Which, by the way, pay attention to threes. Anytime something happens three times, that's always important.
Whatever. Right. Threes. Yeah. Some sort of magical number. Could it give Calpurnia a magic baby?
Magic babies. magic threes. Yep. I don't disagree that that's an interesting interpretation, and I think you could play that pretty well on stage. Actually, that would be a really interesting performance, to have Casca and Cassius be co-conspirators and have this be a made-up story. But I've never considered that in reading the play. Mm. I always just took it at face value.
And the whole idea of it might fall apart if there is the historical context of Plutarch's lives that any normal audience in Shakespeare's day would have known. And so Shakespeare can assume that you know the motive. But if you're examining the text on its own, apart from that knowledge, then it's interesting to me that does become a possibility, right? That Casca might not be a trustworthy trustworthy speaker here. And yet the tendency that I have to just automatically want to trust him, and then have to ask myself, why am I trusting him? Yeah.
Well, his role in it, his temptation, if you want to call it that, is not as overt. It's far more subtle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there are some valuable lessons there. Even if it doesn't hold with interpretation of the whole play, there's certainly some valuable lessons there, right? That just because he's not as direct as Cassius doesn't mean he's not as dangerous.
You feel Cassius's sleaziness, but Casca is hidden with the humor, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything else we need to say about Act One?
I don't know. I feel like we hit the high points. Oh, I did want to hear just really quickly, what are we to make of Mark Antony at this point, since he becomes such a big part of the rest of it? What do you make of him here in Act One?
I think it's an interesting contrast to note Antony running in a race, in contrast to the Antony's out in the public eye, participating in the Roman games, has the ear of Caesar, and then in almost this back room conversation, you have Cassius and Brutus and Casca.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important. So you have Mark Antony almost comes across as like the active ideal Roman man, right? And then you've got Cassius, who seems pretty slimy at this point.
Right. Which itself will get subverted with Mark Antony, I think, but we'd come back to that when we get there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, act absolutely.
Four, I think Act Four is it.
The danger of first impressions.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well, in the same scene as the young Cassius has a lean and hungry look, he thinks too much, such men are dangerous. And he's talking to Antony, and then he expands on that. Caesar does in the next lines. He says, so soon as that spare Cassius, he reads much. He is a great observer, and he looks quite through the deeds of men. He loves no plays, as thou dost, Antony. He hears no music. Seldom he's... Oh, so... Excuse me. So we get here that Antony, just a little glimpse into him as a pleasure-loving man. And so you have to wonder, even now, right, why, if Caesar is saying, I want fat men, which you can interpret as what, sycophants, yes, and here he is with Antony. Is that all Antony is? And it seems to be that's how he's perceived, except they several times mentioned that Antony actually does really love Caesar, mm-hmm. that they are truly deeply, they have a real affection for each other. But that Antony is a, you know, perhaps he is also a sycophant. Again, that gets explored in the rest of the play. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem like anyone thinks much of him right now.
Yeah.
He's certainly not, you certainly don't get much of a glimpse of what he will become later.
Right.
At least not yet.
Right. So is that intentional? Is that an image he's cultivating? Or, and this is something I'm curious about. I've always wondered this about Antony. Is he face value? Is this really who he is now? Or is he cultivating an image? Which, now that I think about it, is the same question about Prince Hal, is a play written very, very closely before this play. So that idea of the one no one really takes seriously or thinks of as a leader emerges with this great strength of character. Was it that Mark Antony was just acting like this in order to get close to power and then he was going to kind of burst onto the scene? Or does that happen because he meets the adversity of losing his leader, so he sees an opportunity and seizes it and then becomes the Mark Antony we know in the rest of his play and in Antony and Cleopatra?
Wait, he loses his leader?
Caesar
dies?
Wait.
Whoops. Spoiler alert. So.
Yeah. First.
Well, my apologies. Spoils.
Thanks for joining us for this one and only episode.
You're fired. You are the weakest link. Goodbye.
It is interesting, though, to see how Cassius and Casca and later Brutus are convinced that Caesar is the threat, mm-hmm. only for it to be revealed that both historically and in the play, Mark Antony was the one to really be afraid of.
That's right.
Well, in fairness, Cassius was on board with that because Cassius does want to kill Mark Antony.
Well, that's true.
And then Brutus is like, nah,
that's true.
Head, what can the arm do?
That's next week. And that is such an important scene. Yeah, spoiler, now you're the weakest link.
Yeah.
Well, we're all dropping like flies.
But now notice too, though, that that
the characters in Shakespeare tragedy.
Exactly.
That Caesar looks to Cassius and says, I don't like him. Mm-hmm. I see him as a threat. And Antony says, oh, no. You don't need to fear him.
Uh-huh. Well, interesting. Yeah.
Right. So everyone gets it right.
What?
Yeah.
Or everyone gets it wrong. Or Mark Antony was Macbething him. Yeah, don't fear him, so he can take you out for me.
All right, this is the question I have about Mark Antony. I'm very curious about him during the early part of his career.
Oh man, just a new conspiracy theory just popped into my head.
Yeah, that's nonsense. Thanks, Brian. I think it's safe to say that we have reached the end of valuable comments for
today. Now we have derailed. We're going to start internet rumors.
No offense, Matt.
And then the aliens came.
Okay, one last comment from me.
Okay.
This is one thing I just want to point out, one last thing. And it just touches back on what you know, Brian, what you've been saying about the different ways to interpret. But in that speech that you just read to us, Heidi, about he reads too much and loves no plays, he hears no music. He loves no plays. See, he doesn't have a mirror. He doesn't have the proper mirror. Right?
I just think Shakespeare put that in there just for fun.
Probably. Probably he couldn't possibly have meant anything by it. But then at the end of it, he says, I rather tell thee what is to be feared than what I fear, for always I am Caesar. So there's the description of his office and the godlike nature of it.
That's then good.
The very next line says, come on my right hand, for this year is death. truly what you'd think, what thou thinkst of him. And now there's the humanity of it, right? But I am still a human being.
Right.
You know, and I think too, Brian, like if I think of Caesar as a tyrant, then I read those two lines parallel to each other and I think, see, the idiot doesn't even deserve to have the ambition that he has.
Huh.
But if but if I think of him as a human being, I think here's a man who is wrestling, like what we say about Elizabeth in The Crown, right? Here's a person wrestling with his personhood, his humanity, and his role as the Caesar, the office.
Right.
Okay. So I think you may have convinced me even with just that because now I'm seeing Caesar as a man who just wants to have a friend.
Yeah. Hmm. I think so. I mean, I think that, never mind. I don't want to go too far down that road because we do see more of it in Act 2.
Yeah.
And that contrast constantly between his role as Caesar and the perception of whether he's grasping at power and then his humanity. Mm-hmm. They're just, it's there all the time.
Yeah.
You know, every single scene, as I said, every action, every word, it's all there, including the way he responds to his wife.
Yeah.
When she has her nightmares.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see both.
Right.
This tension between wanting to be a good husband and wanting to be good Caesar, a good ruler.
Well, and actually being somewhat easily influenced. I think that maybe he's a man who has this ability to lead and command, but is, in relationship, he doesn't seem very discerning of the people around him. They deceive him very easily.
Intimacy is hard for him, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm convinced to see him a little bit more humanized.
Don't give in so soon. You got to fight me for the next 4 acts.
Well, I'm sure we'll find something else.
<That's> true. Very true. Okay, so that's Act 1. We hit all the high points. Closing words, anything else anybody needs to say? We're good there?
No, this has been so fun. I really like this dynamic with the history, the classics, and the literary. I think it's good.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Yeah. It is looking cool. Forward to it.
History nerd, right. Book nerd, philosophy nerd. Whatever.
That's right. It's perfect.
Classicus.
Clackicus. Am I saying it right?
That was perfect. Just always say it that way from now on.
I nailed it.
Well, thank you for joining us for The Plays the Thing, William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, Act 1. We leave this episode promising that next week's episode will include a Heidi White who has a copy of the play with line numbers.
With line numbers. And my word. You have my word.
And hopefully a Brian Phillips minus cough.
Yes.
Right?
Let's hope so. Oh my goodness. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks you everybody for joining us.
I feel bad.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.